Hello, and welcome to Profiles, a program that introduces to WFIU listeners interesting people from Indiana, the United States, and the world. I'm Owen Johnson. Our guest on this occasion is Gerald Kern, Senior Vice President and Editor of the Chicago Tribune. Jerry, welcome to Profiles.
Thank you very much, Owen.
What first got you interested in journalism?
First got interested in journalism when I was a kid and I was intensely interested in the space era. I was kind of a child of Sputnik, right? I remember going out and being fascinated by that and being able to see it go across the sky, and found out that I could learn the schedule by going to the newspaper and find out all the, passages are there in the newspaper. And then as space shots were launched, Gagarin and then Shepard and Glenn, I went out to get the story from, it was the Indianapolis News at the time, the afternoon paper, because I was totally absorbed and fascinated by that and wanted to be an astronomer. And then I discovered that, hey, this thing, this newspaper is pretty interesting too. And I really got interested in what was in the stories, the real-time history that was unfolding. And I went down a completely different pathway.
When did you decide it was going to be a career?
I suppose I decided, frankly, rather late. While I was interested in, the news, I didn't really think about making a profession out of it until I got down to Indiana University. And during the time, of course, it was a time of political activism and a lot of new ideas. And it just seemed like journalism was in the forefront of driving those ideas and being the agenda setter for them. And it just became such a engrossing and alluring professional option that I decided rather late in my college career to go into it.
I suppose at that time it was somewhat like today that there was some debate about what journalism should be doing. Should it be an activist or should it just be reporting? I guess to use an example, if there was a demonstration going on in Dunmeadow outside the School of Journalism, did you participate or did you cover it?
So I did not have journalistic ethics imbued into me at that point in my life. I absolutely participated. And then I would go out and cover things. So that's part of the great experience of going to college, is that you learn all manner of things and you do it by firsthand experience. But the question that you, I guess, ask about what is the role of the news, of say newspapers, I mean it to stand in for all news media and journalism, is, are you a detached observer or are you, part of an advocacy? That debate has been going on from the very beginning and is going on today. And in fact, it's my belief that in the world now, with so much information available through so many channels, I think we have to stand out and stand up for things. We have to mean something. And so that, I think, maybe puts us more in the center of things than off on the sideline just observing in a cool, detached way what's going on.
What do you think was the biggest lesson you learned from your college days?
My experience at Indiana taught me how to be a reporter. It taught me, and that experience, and I think this applies to the college experience in general, helps you learn how to question, how to not just accept what is told to you as fact or, and be able to ask your own questions independently generated about what is the truth, what's the facts, is a certain opinion really valid or not. That's what I think a university experience is supposed to do. And I think being in journalism at that time only helped accentuate that. So I think that's the valuable thing I got. I learned how to question and try to find out the truth for myself.
You have a fascination with history, don't you?
I'm very interested in it. I think I don't consider myself a historian. I try to read as much as I can. I read a fair amount about historical biographies, and I kind of draw on them for lessons. I really believe that the choices that people make in their moments of truth is the place that history is made, and I see it in historical figures on and the choices that they make. And I think to the extent that it can be something of a guidepost for you in your professional life or your daily life, it's valuable.
Is there some historical figure that particularly interests you?
There are a number of them. I've spent some time reading Winston Churchill. Winston Churchill is, I guess, a hero of mine. He was a man who was spent a lot of time in exile, espousing beliefs that nobody, shared. And he sounded a warning, and he laid out a course of action, and no one paid any attention until the very storm that he predicted broke upon the world. And people turned to him, and he was there with, I think, the inspiration to lead his nation out of a very dark time. I think he's an example of maybe one man saving his nation. So I find him utterly fascinating. I think there are others as well. I think Harry Truman is an inspirational guy. He's a figure who the accidental president, who very few people believed were worthy of the mantle of the presidency after FDR. But he was so grounded in his principles and who he was, and he knew who he was and who he wasn't, and that kept him straight and true, and he turned out to be one of the great presidents in American history. So I guess a good lesson from that is, don't judge people too quickly, and, people can be measured by their courage and conviction in times of crisis.
And we can't forget the famous Chicago Tribune headline, "Dewey beats Truman."
Oh, yes. That's right. I have a story about that. That headline, I think that is arguably the most famous newspaper ever, single edition newspaper ever published ever. I can't think of another one that is more recognizable than that one. And that headline haunted the Chicago Tribune for many decades. I remember when I arrived there, it was every election day, there would just be this dread that would you could feel in the newsroom about we do not repeat that piece of history, right? And so when I became editor, obviously interested in history and inquired about that paper, and we did not have a copy of it at the Tribune Tower, certainly nothing that was displayed. And so I went out and I secured one, found a really great copy, and I had it framed, a special frame case made for it, and it's on my wall in my office. And I embrace it because it's a phenomenal piece of American history that we are a part of, and there are fantastic lessons that come from that.
Well, some of those things happened in the year 2000 as well, with people not knowing way things were going to go.
But I will add that they did not happen at the Chicago Tribune in 2000. Our headline was, "As Close as It Gets."
Okay. What was your goal when you left Bloomington to go out into the world?
I wanted to get into the profession, and I wanted to write stories, and I wanted to have a fascinating career. I never expected to become editor of the Chicago Tribune. I thought I might aspire to be editor somewhere, sometime, but I wanted to have a career in journalism because I believe that it was one of the things that you could do that would make the world better, and I couldn't believe that you actually got paid to do it. It was so much fun. Went out into the world, and you know, one thing after another happens. And I was actually talking to some young people. There was a celebration of the School of Journalism's centennial that we hosted at Tribune Tower, and I was talking to some of the Ernie Pyle scholars who were there, and I said, and they were very concerned about their careers and where they want to go and how do they plan for it. And I said, you have to have a general sense of direction. You can't be aimless. You need to know where you want to go. But it is a waste of time and energy to game out every step, because life doesn't happen that way. There is no straight line between where you are now and where your goal is. It's going to be a zigzag. There's going to be lots of surprises, and you need to enjoy the fact that there are going to be surprises.
What was your first job?
My first job, when I graduated, it was a tough economy too, and it was very difficult to get jobs. And so I went to work for a weekly newspaper in my hometown of Indianapolis. And believe it or not, the first job I could get, and I just wanted to get into the business, was selling advertising. And I started out, and I knew I was probably making a mistake to do that, but I said, hey, I need a job, and maybe this gets me closer, and I did that. And I did it for about 6 months, and I finally went to them, and I said, I'm no good at this. I don't want to do it. What I really want to do is write stories and edit and so forth, and I'm going to put it on the table and say, you know, if you let me do that, I'll do a good job for you. If you don't, I'm fine. I'll walk away. You can send me on my way. And they said, okay. So my journalism career was launched in kind of an inauspicious way.
What drew you later on to editing?
Well, I was drawn to editing almost from the beginning. Not that I did not like reporting and writing. I like that too. But I like the notion of being the orchestra conductor, the person that could see how the whole piece of music came together. And I wanted to do that. I was fascinated by that. All the decisions, all the things that go into creating a newspaper, I thought was utterly fascinating. And I knew that very early on that that's what I wanted to do.
Let's take a break here for some music. You've indicated you might be interested in hearing Hey Jude by the Beatles. Why?
Well, I was asked about music, and I thought, well, okay, since I'm back here at the Indiana University campus, I would sort of invoke some memories. And I remember Hey Jude being one of those evocative tunes that I heard while I was here.
Hey Jude, don't make it bad. Take a sad song and make it better. Remember to let her into your heart. Then you can start to make it better. Hey Jude, don't be afraid. You were made to go out and get her. The minute you let her under your skin, then you begin to make it better.
That was Hey Jude by the Beatles, music chosen by our guest on Profiles today, Chicago Tribune editor Gerald Kern. You're listening to Profiles on WFIU.
Production support for Profiles comes from Smithville, a locally owned business serving central and southern Indiana since 1922, with residential and business internet, voice, and security services. Smithville, local pride, global technology. Information at smithville.net.
You've called Christmas Eve 1990, when you were offered a job at the Chicago Tribune, the happiest day of your life. Certainly most people at that time thought newspapers were doing well. What other thoughts did you have?
Well, let me amend that. It was the happiest day of my professional life. I've had happy days when I was married and when my kids were born. So this ranked close to that. But I guess I'll say the reason why it was such it was a happy moment because it seems so improbable. I got started in journalism, and as I mentioned, I got started late. I started at the bottom. I didn't have any internships. I just didn't have any entree to, some of the premier, newspapers or media entities that others had at the time, and I really had to start at the bottom, and so I had worked my way up at some other newspapers. I came up to the Chicago area to work for a paper called the Daily Herald, which took off and became, the third largest paper in Illinois. And I became managing editor and was doing really good work. I think we were doing great work there. Our staff was. And one of the reasons that we, were competitive was that the Chicago Tribune would not hire anybody from the Daily Herald unless you had left and gone someplace else. You had to prove your worthiness by going somewhere else that was bigger and better. What that did was sort of bottle up a lot of talent there, a lot of really good young talent who liked the Chicago area, liked, the fact that we were becoming sort of the third metro. And we just got better and better to the point where we were beating the Chicago Tribune on a lot of stories. So it was very gratifying when I got a phone call one day, and it was Ellen Soderbur, who was the Metro editor at the Chicago Tribune, and she asked me to come down to meet Dick Ciccone, who was the managing editor. They reached out and contacted me, and I went down there and interviewed. And then I interviewed with Dick on Christmas Eve of 1990 and was offered a job. And I just thought it was one of those sort of peak moments in life where, hey, hard work did pay off after all. So it was a wonderful moment.
Did you have any idea at the time where you might end up at the Tribune?
No. I made the leap there, and I thought, well, okay, this is one of the top 10 papers in the United States, and I've always been on the outside looking in. I wanted to see how far I could get. And so I'd say after I was there a couple of years, I got ambitious and said, hey, I'd like to be managing editor here. And I worked very hard towards that, and I was kind of on a pathway to be in the consideration set for that some years later. But it's also, I guess, hearkening back to what I said about there is no straight line. I never thought about being editor. As it turns out, I never got to be managing editor, but I got to be editor. So it was never something that I expected to happen.
When you were in Chicago, was there anything left of the storied tradition of Chicago journalism, the dog-eat-dog hijinks and all of that?
I think that the place had been – I think the profession had been professionalized. I mean, the newsroom was professional. It was ethical. I'd heard a lot of stories about reporters masquerading as police detectives in order to get access to, crime scenes or to prisoners or information inside the offices of the police, almost the front page type antics. I heard people talking about that, but I think those days were gone. We certainly had legends in the building. Mike Royko was certainly at the Sun-Times, but had come to the Tribune by then. Ann Landers, Epi Letterer, was working at the building. Some others that were newer generation, but Gene Siskel was there, Bob Green. So there were all those legendary figures who had stories from their past or from the eras that they came to. I do believe that Chicago is still a fantastic news town. It's always been a fantastic newspaper town. And I think that there's a lot of that kind of zeitgeist that's there, but I think people conduct themselves professionally now. It was a 2008 was a nightmarish time for the newspaper industry in general, and it was the beginning, I think, of the frankly the darkest, most perilous moment in, I think, Chicago Tribune history as well. I took the job because I believe that I had some ideas that would help preserve the core of public service journalism that the Tribune and other big, great newspapers represented, but that it was critical that we act upon them, and that we do it now. So went into the job. It was obviously hugely difficult time. We had had an ownership change. We'd gone from a public company to a private company. With it came a whole new management, whole different set of values, and I'm talking about at the corporate level. There was advertising revenue cratered. We were beginning to enter a dark recession, worst since the Great Depression. And so it was a time that we had to rebuild ourselves. And that meant that we had to go to the proverbial white sheet of paper and say, what is our core mission? What is the most important things that are the most important things that we do? And then be rigorous about building an operation that was focused on those things. So we could not be all things to all people any longer, or attempt to be that any longer. And so we really rebuild ourselves on a couple of ideas. One is that we were going to diversify our portfolio of media. We were going to imprint in online and mobile, and which we did. We were going to become especially digitally focused. But we were going to build this on local investigative reporting. That was the most important thing that we could do, especially in a state that corruption is legendary in. And maybe I can tell a story about what propelled us into that. And I've told this story many times in speeches and around the region. December 9th, 2008 was one of the most important days in Chicago Tribune history, and it was embodied on the front page of the paper that day. We reported that Tribune Company, our parent company, had filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection. And so that's obviously sent a shock through us, and I think through the Chicago community as well as our readers, about asking, well, does that mean that the Tribune is going to survive? Right next to it, we broke a story that day about the federal U.S. Attorney Patrick Fitzgerald's probe of Governor Rob Blagojevich, now centering on allegations that he sold the Senate seat just vacated by Barack Obama for campaign donations. And so the juxtaposition of those two stories, I think, told us what we had to do. We had to solve these economic problems in order to make sure that kind of investigative reporting could live on. And it was an absolute exclamation point, moment of truth for us. And I gathered our team together and I said, no matter what we do, we have to make some hard decisions. And it will not make – some people will not be happy about it. But we have to ensure that, we're here to do that kind of work. We found out in the subsequent later that day when Fitzgerald explained the charges against Blagojevich, that the governor had targeted us at the Chicago Tribune. He wanted our editorial board fired because we were all over him about things and critical of him. And so, as I've said, however bizarre that may have been and all, it just showed us how important we were and how influential we could be to make this city and state better. So we did that. We certainly had to reduce staff like other newspapers in the country did, but we rebuilt it. We actually increased our resources for investigative reporting and a certain kind watchdog reporting, which is holding government accountable. And we said we wanted to have that in be the hallmark of the paper and have that every day. And we've come pretty close to doing that since then. In fact, we've done a front page watchdog investigative story every day, you know, over the last couple of weeks. That's, I think, given us a focal point for what we've done. I think that we've also taken a lead in terms of opinion leadership. We've began publishing editorials on our front page and on our front of our website for the first time in 30 years. We've been leading campaigns for political reform, for government reforms of various kinds, and we've been loud about it and we have been tough about it. And people have responded to that. Now, since then, in the 2 years that have unfolded since, we've actually been able to build back our staff. We've added about 15%. We've grown our staff by about 15% since April of 2009, and I don't know of another newspaper in the country that can say that. We've expanded our local reporting. We've launched new publications. We're on a growth trajectory despite the hardships that we've gone through. So I'm very proud of the staff and how their grit and determination during this period of time.
I guess I'm puzzled a little bit. Many other newspapers would have wanted to do the same thing and have not succeeded. What's the secret?
One of the things that we have at the Chicago Tribune is a critical mass. We started out with a pretty good sized staff. And when you have those kinds of resources, you can reallocate them and you can re-engineer and do a lot of things with that. I don't think we'd fallen down to some point below critical mass, which made a difference, which would make that difficult. And it was my goal to ensure that that didn't happen. So, for instance, you know, newspapers were cutting their staff sort of routinely across the board. We decided we weren't going to do that. We re-engineered newspapers are and newsrooms, and I use the word newspaper. I mean newsrooms and all the media that we publish are editor-intensive operations, a lot of production editing. We figured out how we could do production editing with fewer people and move those jobs to investigative reporting jobs. We did that. We began to work with our partners in the company, the Los Angeles Times, we consolidated our Washington bureaus and our foreign bureaus. It just made no sense for us to operate separate systems, and there were millions of dollars that could be reallocated that way. We simply went through every dollar, every person, every activity, and we zero-based it, and we asked ourselves, is it mission critical? Is it something that we add value by doing it ourselves? Is it something that we can get from someplace else? Or do we stop doing it altogether? And we did that, and we did that in a period of about 2 months. And that freed up resources to be able to do these other things. We also made investments. And I credit our publisher, Tony Hunter. He understood that for us to succeed, we have to be the definitive source of news and information for and about Chicago. And we invested into that. We hired 20 new reporters to cover the region better. We hired, a suburban watchdog team of another 10. We made some investments knowing that that was important for us in the future.
Who is your competition now?
Our competition is anything, any device, any medium that takes information, is communicated across, and people spend time with. Our competition is not ink on paper newspapers. That's one of many. So you can get news and information across your Xbox. That's a competitor. You can get news and information in all kinds of forms. You can get it certainly from Facebook. So we recognize people have choices. There's never been more information. The result has been that the news, great swaths of news, have become commoditized. You know, it used to be that you could only get them from the newspaper, from television or radio. Now you can get them from everywhere. So what we had to do is say, we're going to focus on valuable, differentiated news that nobody can do better. We have to be great at doing a few things and make sure that people know that and can see the value in it. And we did that. And I think that helps us compete with any source of information.
Am I correct that there are now two Chicago Tribunes, one for the city and one for the suburbs?
No, there's actually more than that. When you talk about just ink on paper, there's the Chicago Tribune that is most recognizable, the Colonel McCormick's newspaper, except for today. That's a broadsheet. And for those that don't know that, that's the kind of the wide, you know, that's the newspaper that unfolds and every day has sections in it. We also publish simultaneously a tabloid version of that, which is, compact form. We're the only, local media company in the country that publishes simultaneously in both formats. That's on the newsstand. It's primarily a commuter edition, and that's, sold there. We publish another tabloid called Red Eye, which is for young urban professionals under 40. It's a free publication. And by the way, it's the largest circulation daily newspaper in the city limits of Chicago, larger than the Sun-Times, more paper circulate than the Sun-Times or the Chicago Tribune. We also publish Oi, which is our Spanish language daily. So we publish a high school weekly newspaper for 150,000 kids in school. So we have followed fragmenting audiences by publishing multiple editions. There may be more in the future. On the digital side, we publish ChicagoTribune.com. We launched in this last 18 months three breaking news centers, Chicago Breaking News, Chicago Breaking Sports, Chicago Breaking Business. We've launched a blog network called Chicago Now, which has, I think, upwards of 500 blogs on it. And we've seen sort of a rocket ride of page views on that. We've started a shopping channel. We have a weather center. I mean, we have launched many, many new vehicles to capture those fragmenting audiences. So we're not just a newspaper.
Let's take a break here for some more music. On the list, I see you've chosen Sympathy for the Devil by the Rolling Stones.
You know, Hey Jude was it was an innocent time. I'm hearkening back to my college days, but there was also some, darkness and some threatening ideas out there, too. And I thought the Rolling Stones represented that.
Sympathy for the Devil, music chosen by our guest on Profiles today, Gerald Kern, the editor of the Chicago Tribune. Where is the newspaper business going to be in, say, 10 or 15 years?
It won't be it isn't now, the newspaper business. It's a media business. We have been through some really rocky times, as we talked about. And I think we've passed through those storms. And I think we became leaner and fitter for survival as a result. What's the old adage? That doesn't kill you makes you strong. I think that's what happened with us. So I think we're much more grounded, much more innovative, quicker to action. But we are going to have to pick up the pace, and we're going to have to understand that this fundamental transformation that we're undergoing is not going to stop. It's never going to stop. And so we have to, you know, embrace technology, follow fragmenting audiences, develop new media all the time, and understand that that's required of us. At the same time, I'll say I'm not a technologist. I believe it's essential to our success, but I think the magic is really in the content that we create and the job that we do for people. And I think as long as we do that and do that really well and understand what it is that's valuable, it doesn't matter what channel it's sent through. So I think at the core of it is we've come up with six principles that guide us at the Chicago Tribune. And the first one is we stand up for the community. We act as a champion. We do the investigations. We hold our government accountable. We try to level the playing field. That, I think, is the most important thing that we can do, and I think there's never been a greater need for it. One of our principles is that we capture what the Chicago experience, and so that means, you know, tell what it means to live, work, and play in this city at this time in history. We have to move people emotionally as well as intellectually. It's no good if we can't connect with people on an emotional plane as well as an intellectual one and get them to care about the people we write about and therefore care about us. We have to help people navigate their daily lives. We have to fuel conversation. And we must break news, not just report it. It's no longer sufficient just to report news that you can get from everywhere else. And I think that we've applied those to everything we do. So thinking ahead 10 or 15 years, if we've done that, that's providing a benefit to people that they will not be able to get from anywhere else and that they'll need. And as long as we keep those things in sight, I think we'll be fine. It's just that the forms will be varied and different than they are right now.
Is there a risk in the sense that newspapers used to reach a mass audience and in a way presented an agenda for common discussion? When things go into many different platforms, do we lose that common agenda?
I think that's an excellent question. I think that is the choice of the marketplace, though. That's our choice as individuals to gain information in whatever form and time that we want. I think we have to deal with that. There's no reason, though, that even though the audiences have been splintered and that the channels are multifaceted, there's no reason why we cannot find common ground, as long as common ground exists, right? I believe that human beings are not much different today than maybe they were, I don't know, 100,000 years ago in terms of their needs. Certainly the culture and the civilization is different, but they still need the same things. They need to know where there's danger. I think there's a sense of fairness they want to see served. They want their, you know, immediate, practical, pragmatic needs met. And so I think we are actually the news industry is in excellent position to do that. And I think newspapers have been the torchbearer for setting a common agenda for the community for forever. And in fact, I think that's even more of a role for us to play, you know, going forward than it has been. I think we've been reluctant to be the campaigner or the crusader for reforms. We just have. And I think if you look back at the history of newspapers in this country, they served the purpose of coalescing communities and setting agenda and providing a forum. They were conveners. And I think our role as convener whether it's virtual or in real time and space, in a world that's been atomized and fragmented, I think is a huge opportunity for us. I think we have to embrace that and understand that we have to be more than just purveyors of news and information. We have to stand for something and help move people towards goals.
Do you see the day when the old-fashioned print product will disappear and we'll just get our basic newspaper on iPad or Kindle or something of that sort?
I think that's possible. I don't think it's – I think it'll be a while. I'm very interested in the tablet technology. I think the iPad has been a revolutionary device, I use it every day, and I'm still experimenting and playing with it. But it seems to me that some version of a tablet that is going to come along, shortly, will begin to be convenient enough to use, and then we'll integrate not only text but video and all media. There'll be a convergence there. That will be very powerful as a source of news, information, and interaction. So I don't discount that, I think we need to get ready, and we are now, to use that. I still think that there's an experiential nature to ink on paper, to print. That's the reason I think books are not going to disappear. Yes, I can read, and I do read books on my iPad or my Kindle, but I still want to be able to pull that book down from a shelf and feel it and touch it and experience it that way. So I think that at some point there may be a change in what we expect in terms of the printed newspaper. It may be less frequent. It may be in a more of a magazine form. That will be determined by the audience and the experience at once. Some point way out in the future, it may be that paper is not necessary any longer and that the devices that we are developing right now fully deliver that experience. I don't know.
Some listeners might find me remiss if I didn't ask a question about one of the political figures from Chicago, and that is Barack Obama as covering his government in the White House and being from Chicago presented you with particular problems?
It's a fascinating moment in history to have the president of the United States from Chicago. And so there are – Chicago connections are manifold not only in his presidency but also in the people that he's brought with him to power.
And the mayor who is now back.
Yes. And so that makes Chicago one of the – the nexus of some of the most fascinating political stories in the country right now. Some of the difficulties, I think, are mostly in our own heads, and that is, okay, the president's from Chicago. Does that mean that everything the president does is intensely interesting to people in Chicago? And I think the answer is no. We want to cover him, and we want insight and depth, and we want to be able to record history in this special moment in history. But there's a lot of sausage making in the government, right? You need to have it. It needs to be there. But because Barack Obama happens to be the president doesn't necessarily add some special value to it, right? So we still have to keep our news judgments in place. It's just nothing but opportunity, and it's a lot of fun.
On the way out, we're going to listen to music by the Moody Blues. Where does that come in?
That song was a lot about a personal exploration, people questioning at the time, their place in the world and also what they thought about inside their own heads.
That brings us to the conclusion of this conversation. Our guest today has been Gerald Kern, editor of the Chicago Tribune. Jerry, thanks for being here.
Thank you very much. Pleasure.
To our listeners, we're pleased you joined us. For WFIU, I'm Owen Johnson.
Why do we never get an answer when we're knocking at the door? With a thousand million questions about hate and death and war. Cause when we stop and look around us, there is nothing that we need. In a world of persecution that is burning its greed.
The program you just heard was recorded in March of 2011. The studio engineer and technical producer was Michael Paskash. Production support for Profiles comes from Smithville, a locally owned business serving central and southern Indiana since 1922, with residential and business internet, voice, and security services. Smithville, local pride, global technology. Information at smithville.net. Copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. Information about Profiles, including archives of past shows, can be found on our website, wfiu.org. Profiles is a production of WFIU and comes from the studios at Indiana University. Mia Partlow, producer. Please join us again for the next edition of Profiles. For WFIU, thanks for listening.